Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Cure Talk. I'm Priya Menon, Scientific Media Editor at Cure Talk, joining you from India. And I welcome all of you for a discussion on prostate cancer. All Cure Talk shows on prostate cancer are conducted in association with the Prostate Cancer International and the Prostate Cancer Foundation. This is the seventh time we are discussing prostate cancer on the Cure Talk platform. On our previous episode on prostate cancer, we discussed clinical trials with Dr. Ian Thompson from the University of Texas Health Science Center. On this show, we have the Chair of the Department of Urology, Associate Director and Senior Vice President for Translational Research at Roswell Park Cancer Institute, Dr. James Mahler, discussing national guidelines for prostate cancer treatment. Dr. Mahler, who chairs the National Comprehensive Cancer Network's Prostate Cancer Treatment Guidelines Panel, will also highlight the latest research available to us that can help diagnose high-risk forms of prostate cancer and avoid unnecessary treatments for low-risk forms. Welcome to Cure Talk, Dr. Mahler.
Thank you very much.
My co-host for the show is Michael E. Scott. Mike is co-founder and president of Prostate Cancer International, health strategist of Calcium, member of the board of directors of the National Organization for Rare Diseases and the International Myeloma Foundation. Supporting Dr. Mahler and Mike on the panel are experienced and knowledgeable prostate cancer survivors and advocates Tony Crispino and Paul Carpenter. Tony Crispino is a patient advocate at SWOG, where today he works with some of the industry's finest researchers on the latest clinical trials. An advanced disease survivor himself for over 6 years, Tony has run online discussion forums, live support groups, and is currently the president of US2 Las Vegas and a member of the American Society of Clinical Oncology. Paul Carpenter is a patient advocate for men diagnosed with prostate cancer. He has contributed to dozens of online groups and forums and also co-founded a Los Angeles support group for gay and bisexual men living with prostate cancer. I extend a hearty welcome to all panelists and to all our listeners. Towards the end of the hour, we will be discussing questions sent in via email. You can mail your questions to priya@trialx.com. Or if you want to ask a question live, please press 1 on your keypads and we will bring you on air to ask them. With that, I hand over to Mike to begin with the discussion. Mike, you're on air.
Good afternoon, Dr. Mahler. Thank you very much for taking the time to join us.
My pleasure.
We had asked you, I think, prior to the program, to talk to us a little bit about some of the evolving issues in the diagnosis of prostate cancer, particularly in the most recent update to the NCCN guidelines. We've obviously noted that you've included information now about the potentially appropriate use of multiparametric MRI in diagnosis and also in active surveillance. And you've mentioned also the issue of the multiple new genetic and genomic tests that are coming to market. But clearly for the patient community, additional guidance about when people feel these are more or less appropriate forms of testing would be extremely useful. So I'd be interested in you talking a bit about some of the most recent and important updates to the NCCN guidelines, but also focusing on those two particular issues, if you would care to do that for a little while.
Yeah, I'd be happy to begin our discussion that way. It's been very interesting for me to watch my colleague Peter Carroll over the last 2 years improve the prostate cancer early detection guidelines. I think they've been made much simpler and therefore much more user-friendly, And I urge all your listeners to pay careful attention to the simplification, which is largely encompassed in the second page of the guideline, PROS D2. We're very particular about the use of PSA for early detection and for guiding treatment because we discovered it here at Roswell Park. I still think that PSA is best used not as a snapshot, in other words, not just paying attention to what a value is on a given day, but it's most valuable when it's used in conjunction with prior values so that you're able to look at what we call PSA kinetics, whether you do that by calculating a PSA velocity or a PSA doubling time. This additional information provided by PSA then makes many of the nomograms much more useful and can personalize the use of PSA to your particular situation, especially when you combine what your PSA kinetics are with your own age and health and other parameters such as your digital rectal exam, your family history, et cetera, et cetera. So now that brings us to how to use a PSA to prevent a man from suffering from PSA anxiety. And I frequently say that should perhaps be a new psychiatric definition because so many men are so focused upon their PSA, both men who don't have prostate cancer and as well, and more appropriately so, those men who have prostate cancer, where PSA is far more valuable for monitoring their disease. But I think what the Sloan Kettering Group has shown us is that if you are fortunate enough to have a low PSA, you don't have to get anxious every year, or in some cases, some urologists even use a PSA every 6 months, which there's absolutely no data that they should be performed that frequently. But if your PSA is less than one and you're less than 50 years old, you are in a very, very good place. And you probably don't need another PSA until you turn 50 years old. Now, if you're higher risk group, such as you're African American, you have a first degree relative with prostate cancer, you probably want to get a PSA a little more often, maybe every year or two. The modeling suggests that every 2 years is optimal. And then when you get to that 50th birthday, the current NCCN guidelines recommend PSA every 1 to 2 years. And again, you can tailor it based upon your risk factors. And as long as your PSA stays less than three, you're in a pretty good group. And then you should begin to think as you get older about whether it's worth the risk of having a prostate cancer detected that you didn't want to have detected. In other words, that you're not going to live long enough to suffer a death from prostate cancer, and hence why know about it, and more importantly, why suffer the consequences of side effects of treatment when you probably didn't need the treatment in the first place. So we're encouraging men when they reach a physiologic age of 70, notice I didn't say chronologic age, but a physiologic age of 70, they probably can forego any additional PSAs. If we did everything I just mentioned, if we complied with the NCCN guidelines, we would see a tremendous reduction in the cost, both financial and anxiety-wise, associated with overuse of PSA, which leads to overdetection of prostate cancer. So with that as a baseline, let me now talk about the use of multiparametric MRI. And this is a three-part study, which then requires a rather sophisticated computer analysis of the images to calculate some numerical data that allows radiologists to assign low, intermediate, or high risk of a lesion being an aggressive prostate cancer. We're learning a lot about three-parameter MRI or multiparametric MRI, And it appears to have an advantage that it rarely sees the little well-differentiated cancers that I call autopsy-type cancer that all men get as they age. Your chance of having that type of cancer is about the same as your age in percent. So I'm 61 years old. I have a 61% chance of talking to you today, having an indolent prostate cancer in my prostate. Now, I don't want to be biopsied to find that out, and it appears an advantage of the multi-parameter MRI is it doesn't see this type of cancer, and it may see the aggressive ones. So right now, when a man has an elevated PSA and has had a negative routine biopsy, the NCCN guidelines suggest that a multi-parameter MRI may be appropriate to make sure you're not missing an aggressive prostate cancer. In addition, MRI might be useful in treatment planning for men who are concerned whether nerve preservation is appropriate or not when they have a bulky prostate cancer or a prostate cancer that is poorly differentiated. Then the last way to personalize your prostate cancer situation is to take advantage of the new molecular tests that are available. And there are many of them, and that's confusing many men and many of us urologists as well. There are three about which the most is known at the present time. These are the assays from Prolaris Corporation, the Oncotype DX prostate cancer assay, and the Decipher assay. And each of these takes advantage of the expression of genes that are by the prostate cancer that can be used in most cases to guess at the growth rate and hence the aggressiveness of the prostate cancer. So some of the tests recognize an aggressive cancer, others recognize the absence of an aggressive cancer. And so some men who should be undergoing active surveillance of a low-risk cancer might find themselves more able to live with the anxiety of watching something called cancer if they knew that a molecular test was consistent with a low growth rate. Other men faced with an elevated PSA might like to take advantage of newer ways of analyzing PSA or of different tests that can be performed on the urine or the serum that might help them to decide whether they should have a biopsy or not if they're fearful of missing an aggressive cancer. So these new molecular tests are coming along at a very rapid rate. They go through a very different approval process at the FDA. And so, as I wrote in the NCCN treatment guideline, I'm a little concerned that we're going to have to depend on the marketplace to properly position them as to whether they're valuable to help men with their decision-making or not. And in the meantime, we don't have clear evidence that they will help with decision-making. That will need to be accumulated. And so many of the insurance companies are declining to pay for these, and the common denominator to many of these tests is they're quite expensive.
So perhaps I could just ask a couple of questions, Dr. Muller, for clarification. My understanding is that the MPMRI test is available at a relatively limited number of centers at the present time and does require some very sophisticated uropathological skills in order to interpret the imagery and this sort of thing. So I'm curious how fast you think that technology is starting to spread out into the broader community. And the other question I was going to ask you was very specifically about the PCA3 test, where we're seeing some fairly some differences of opinion about the value of the test.
All right, so I always have trouble remembering more than one question at a time, but I'll try and handle this. So let's take the multi-parameter MRI first. This is a technologically demanding test that requires basically three MRIs in one. It has to be done on a 3T magnet. And then it requires a rather sophisticated analysis of the images. So that's sophisticated software. But most importantly, you have to have an experienced uroradiologist who's very good at interpreting these. So that it's not enough for a man to go and say, do you have a 3T magnet? Or are you capable of analyzing all three parameters of a complex MRI, but you also have to know, do they have a radiologist or radiologist highly skilled in this area? So we're very concerned that the results that are being published now, largely as single institution experiences, are going to be very difficult to disseminate through community practices and even smaller academic settings that don't see as many patients with prostate cancer. So this is another example of where it's not just the technology, it's the people that go with the technology that are going to make this valuable. And if this can't be disseminated, it's going to have to stay in centers of excellence, and then patients are going to be inconvenienced because to realize the value of a three-parameter MRI in these particular situations I mentioned, they're going to have to travel. The other thing I should mention about three-parameter MRI is if you have one shortly after a prostate biopsy, it will be uninterpretable because of the bleeding and inflammation that results from the biopsy. So I'm already seeing far too many patients that have a diagnosis of prostate cancer and then the next week have a three-parameter MRI and are told that their cancer is really advanced or they can't have their nerve spared or whatever, and all the radiologist is doing is confusing the bleeding and inflammation that results from prostate biopsy with an aggressive cancer. With regard to the PCA3, this test was developed by a good friend of mine, so I don't allow that to bias me. All of these tests that are used to help a man decide what to do when the PSA is between 2.5 and 10, I do not believe have been critically enough evaluated in the context of PSA kinetics. It's very important that these tests give added information above and beyond PSA kinetics. But what I just said is very controversial. It's kind of my personal opinion, and I hate to do this to patients out there, but this is an area where more research is necessary. It's very important. I still believe personally that I would rather see PSA values measured once a year for several years than any test of PSA derivatives or alternatives to the PSA test at this time based on what I know, but this is not my particular area of expertise. So I wouldn't take what I said to the bank.
So I'm sure we're going to have lots more questions for you that we can come back to, but I think at this stage what I'd like to do is ask my other two panelists if they have questions, and perhaps we could begin with Paul Carpenter, because I'm sure Tony's got six written down, and Paul might only have three or four.
Well, thank you for that, Mike. This is Paul Carpenter. Dr. Muller, you mentioned the three well-known genetic tests from Prolaris, Oncotype DX, and Decipher. All of these, at least so far as I know, seem to take the scattershot approach of looking at a few dozen high-profile genes. Are there other forms of genetic testing, perhaps still in the works, that take a different approach other than the scattershot?
Well, I'm not sure exactly what you mean by scattershot, but...
Well, let me clarify. It looks at, say, as I recall, Prolaris looks at 46 different genes and has a rather complicated weighting algorithm. These genes are protective, these genes are susceptible, and comes up with a single number running it through their algorithm.
Yeah, Prolaris actually uses 31 genes that were selected a priori. These are genes that are associated with cellular proliferation. And so it's that's why I say it's not exactly a scattershot. Now, the Oncotype DX test looked at more of a scattershot of genes and then arrived at a group of 17 that seemed to convey the prognostic information. Decipher is even more of a scattershot in that it seeks to look at all genes that are expressed plus genes that are not expressed. And it allows the outcome to derive the predictor. So every one of these has a little bit different strategy and has different aspects of how much of a scattershot it is versus how much human thought went into I won't say biasing the assay, but directing the assay. So the most interesting thing to me is that these three major companies that we've talked about, I am very impressed with the way they're going about the development of these tests, how open they are, how participatory they are with the academic research community. And I believe they're even having some discussions about cooperating to see which of the tests provide the best information in which situation. So I really look forward to a future where we know which tests to use when and most importantly, whether we can make these tests better as they're used more and more.
That sounds very hopeful. One thing that I wanted to respond to was less hopeful when you said, if I understood correctly, the NCCN does not yet have, I don't know, the budget or the expertise to evaluate this rapidly evolving field. And for the time being, we're going to have to depend on market forces. I worry about that. I wonder if you could comment any further.
Well, the biomarker development is a completely different field of medicine. It's under a whole different system of regulation by the FDA than is drug development.
Right.
The NCCN does not conduct clinical trials. NCCN is an organization that relies upon assembling panels of experts to review newly published information and where sufficient information does not exist to provide expert opinion as to the best way to go. The section on molecular testing in the NCCN guidelines, which is manuscript page 4, every word was very carefully chosen to not overpromise, to not be too excited, to be realistic, and to call for additional testing where necessary. So right now, it's a tough decision whether to use any one of these tests because they have not been rigorously tested as to whether they result in decision-making that is better or not. Most of the studies have been done using what's called retrospective prospective analysis, where you're looking at banked specimens where the outcome is known. Problem with prostate cancer, as you all know, is it grows so slowly, even when it's aggressive, that if we're going to use these tests to guide our future decision-making and then look at an outcome like survival, that, you know, my grandchildren are going to have to interpret those studies.
Yes. I quite appreciate the dilemma or the trilemma facing you. in trying to keep up with the evolving technology. And I was just curious to know, how do you guys keep up? And thank you for your answer.
This is Tony. How are you all doing? And Happy New Year, Dr. Mueller. I'd like to kind of elaborate a little bit on where you just went with retrospective views of trying to get some significant useful data. Clearly, randomized clinical trial is going to be a problem, especially in anything that involves an active surveillance patient, because they have to be so long and very expensive. Currently at SWOG, we're looking backwards, like you say, into the banks, and we're lucky to have the PCPT and the select banks that exist for us. But going backwards and looking and compiling some data and trying to arrive at some reasonable hypothesis for a clinical trial. Can you mention any other types of backward-looking banks that might be useful in helping us get some data until such an RCT can eventually be done?
Yeah, so there are many banks of archival specimens at all our academic centers. The problem is that a tissue biospecimen only has value if you have outcome connected to it. And so, again, I don't like to say what's difficult to do, but it's easy to collect a bunch of archival prostate tissue from men with cancer. It's harder to annotate those specimens with good clinical data so you understand exactly who it is you're looking at. And then it's even more difficult to follow them or to have followed them for a period of time necessary for them to declare whether whatever you're seeing in the tissue predicted that outcome or not. So I'll give you a simple example. One of the biggest problems in prostate cancer right now is the man who undergoes potentially curative therapy, and the only evidence of disease recurrence is a persistent or a relapse by PSA. Yet, a man who has a PSA detectable after failed curative therapy has a mean prostate cancer limited life expectancy of about 20 years. So, surprise, surprise, we can't get anyone interested in conducting clinical trials in this space. Now, you asked about active surveillance, and let's go backwards. That's even worse. An active surveillance patient with an autopsy-type prostate cancer that I talked about before, they're NCCN low risk or very low risk, they have about a 20 to 30% chance of progressing to some form of treatment. If that treatment in an active surveillance population is going to be nearly 100% curative, and so you're never going to know whether they actually needed to be treated or not, because all of them will be treated, and the cure rates will be virtually 100%. Now you're going to compare that to people on active surveillance who show no evidence of progression, and because you detected their cancer by PSA, it would be at least 10 years before they would have developed a nodule, and we know from then that the mean life expectancy is on the order of 12 to 15 years. So you can see the simple numbers game and the expense associated with any type of trials in this workspace, whether you're beginning with already acquired tissue or you're trying to do something prospectively, just because of how slow-growing prostate cancer is.
So, Dr. Mueller, that raises an interesting question about whether, and I'm not going to try and hold you to anything in particular, but has the NCCN committee actually discussed the issue of the possibility of changing the nomenclature of low-risk prostate cancer?
We have had discussions about that. In fact, there was a very excellent debate between Jonathan Epstein from Johns Hopkins and from Cornell.
Rubenstein.
Mark Rubin, thank you. I'm so bad on names. Mark That's Rubin from answer. Cornell, where they debated whether NCCN or AUA low-risk prostate cancer should be renamed, whether Gleason grade 3 plus 3 equals 6 prostate cancer, in essence, should still be called prostate cancer. And it was a very interesting debate. It produced a lot of questions from the audience, and they actually had each of them argue the other one's position, so it was also rather amusing. Now, we all know that there are Gleason grade 3 plus 3 equals 6 prostate cancers that are misgraded either because of sampling errors, or they possibly could turn into more aggressive cancer with time. So I don't think it's a good idea, and the NCCN panel did not want to get into a renaming. I think what people need to understand is that NCCN very low risk and low risk prostate cancer are extremely unlikely to ever cause your death, and should only be treated if there's evidence of growth. But our problem is we're still arguing about what should be the proper criteria for evidence of growth. And that brings us all the way back in a 360-degree circle to the molecular markers as to whether they can better detect a prostate cancer that's growing, rather than what I actually rely on quite heavily, which is PSA kinetics from the time of diagnosis. But there's a very excellent paper from Hopkins cautioning that PSA kinetics will not detect everyone whose cancer is progressing. But again, as I said before, if you find evidence of progression by biopsy and treat everyone, you'll never know whether you really had to treat them all. So I just want to convey to the audience that how difficult this whole area of investigation is. So I understand why it's frustrating to patients, it's frustrating to us, but it's also what makes it so interesting. And all the uncertainty connected with virtually every aspect of prostate cancer should empower patients, because you can evaluate the information and make whatever decision you wish, because no matter what decision you make, somebody will tell you it's right and somebody will tell you it's wrong. So you can make the one that's best for you, and then just don't pay any attention to everybody else.
I don't know if you actually saw this, but there was a very interesting paper from Australia just the other day on decision analysis, looking at the ways Australian men made decisions about whether they should or shouldn't have PSA tests, based on the risk of the potential futures that they would be faced with if they were diagnosed or not diagnosed or had to pay for certain types of therapy or whatever. I mean, it didn't resolve the problem in any way, but it did give some very interesting perspective into how patients thought based on their age and whether they'd had PSA tests before and things like that.
No, I have not seen that paper, but we need to do a lot more research about decision-making.
Right. I'll see if I have your email address. I'll see if I can find I'll see if I can send it to you, because the author was kind enough to send it to me.
That would be great.
Paul, to get back to you, do you have another question?
Actually, this sort of ties in with what we were just arriving at, and that is the balance between quality of life and length of life. And that's a balance that every man facing prostate cancer has to come up with. Implicitly or explicitly, I think the NCC guidelines make some kind of determination that if PSA testing is done at this early an age, there might be so much overtreatment, if it's delayed until this late, and so forth. And I'm wondering, could those factors be made explicit? Have they been made explicit as to, for example, in Great Britain, there's the quality of life year, the QALY, I forget what it stands for. I'm wondering if NCCN has anything similar to make explicit its guidelines for what's over treatment for too many people, under treatment for too many people.
Right. So the term that you're trying to find is quality adjusted life years remaining. But
that's it. Yes.
Right. And that and that the problem with that is it is subject to the values of an individual. So
that was going to be my follow-up question. So
yep.
Yes, I quite
so
agree.
So one man, you'll say to him, if you undergo radiation, you will have a 70% chance of being impotent 10 years from now. And he'll go, well, that's no big deal. I'll be 70. The next man will go, 70%? I'm not doing that. So the quality adjustment has to be done for each individual person, and it's very complicated to do correctly. And so typically that type of research is done on a population basis where when we're sitting in the doctor-patient in an examining room, you have to do it for an individual. And that's
right.
Where this is so difficult because statistics apply to the other 99 guys. They don't apply to me. And so what you have to do is present the statistics and then allow the patient to decide where they themselves fit amongst all those statistics.
So I couldn't agree more.
Yeah, I'm a big believer. My job is to educate patients. It's their job to decide what to do. At the end of a visit, I will say to them, you know, if you want me to, you know, like when I was younger, I'd say, if you were my dad, this is what I would recommend. Now it's like if you're me. Based on what I know, I think I would do this. But statistics, you want to use statistics to inform people, not confuse them. And you want to remember that all it does is give you you're painting a broad picture with statistics, but then you got to figure out where you're going to be.
Dr. Moore,
I quite agree.
People like Paul and Tony and I are often on the receiving end of questions from patients about the side effects related to treatment. And one of the things that I've felt over the years is that we're all faced with a problem that the side effects, particularly erectile dysfunction and incontinence that are presented in papers related to the treatment of prostate cancer, are based on very different standards from institution to institution and often underplay the significance of those side effects to the patients in the sense that if you can get an erection at all, you're potent. Which certainly isn't the way most men actually think about being potent. Would you care to comment on that?
You raise a very, very important point, and that is that most urologists and radiation oncologists, because of what they do, believe in what they do. In other words, if I got a nail, find me a hammer. What you have to do as a patient is you have to inquire carefully about the individual experience of the treating physician using their modality. And if your physician is quoting, I always like to say, Dr. Walsh's experience at Johns Hopkins, then you need to go further. And there's some basic rules of thumb that Dr. Walsh actually advanced years ago, that a radiation oncologist or a urologist should have done in their career at least 100 of what they're proposing to do to you, and they should do at least one a month of what they're proposing to do to you. Now, I personally wouldn't let anyone operate on me that does a prostatectomy once a month and had done only 100 in their career. But you got to look at this very carefully because the person that is the best radiation oncologist or the best urologist is the person who does the procedure relatively rarely but has really good results because they've figured out how to do it safely. And that's who I think we should be studying. There are lots of people out there that do thousands of procedures wrong. So you got to be careful here. Now, the other side of the coin, I just talked about numbers, experience. The other side of the coin is to specifically ask that individual, whether it's a radiation oncologist or a urologist, what their impotence rates are, what their incontinence rates are, what their rectal irritability rates are. Most importantly, what's the secondary cancer treatment rate? And if they can't tell you their own results, then you should go look for another person to treat you. All of us that are obsessive, compulsive, and good have databases, and we know exactly what our results are, because if we stray from what we think is good, we got to figure out why and make an adjustment. Did that kind of answer your question?
Yes, the part of it. But the other part is, it would really make people like me a lot happier if there were, if everybody used the same standards for measuring things like erectile dysfunction and incontinence. I mean, we've got a lot better than we used to be, but there's still a lot of variation in the way it's actually reported in published data.
Yeah, you're exactly right. When I came to Roswell Park 11 years ago, we put in place immediately, because we were starting a robotic program, a standardized way of assessing the quality of life of everyone. And we relied largely on Mark Litwin's instruments to do that. But there's not enough granularity in the UCLA instrument for erectile dysfunction, so instead we use the sexual health inventory, the SHIM. But these instruments are out there, they're well validated, and they should be being used by everyone to do exactly what you're recommending, to use standardized forms of evaluating the side effects of these different treatments. Now, I want to come back to one thing that you mentioned earlier about active surveillance. The NCCN guidelines, and I've been on a crusade about the need to right-size treatment. So what you don't want to do is treat everyone in whom you can diagnose prostate cancer. By the same token, you wouldn't want to never treat anyone in whom you can diagnose prostate cancer. But everybody lives in between those two extremes I just gave. And what we're trying to do is right-size treatment so that those people who have aggressive prostate cancer get a lot of treatment, and hopefully we can cure them. And those men who have a low-risk prostate cancer can avoid treatment until such time that we can demonstrate that their cancer's really grown. And we now know, with this growing active surveillance experience, which now exceeds 4,000 men reported in the published literature, that we have yet to have a single death once we recognize that we shouldn't have subjected the 3 patients in Toronto to active surveillance. We have not had a single death since in those 4,000 men. So we now know that active surveillance is safe for many men. And I'm very proud that NCCN led the charge for this, where we routinized our guidelines so that beginning in 2009, that men with low-risk prostate cancer and life expectancy less than 10 years, active surveillance was the only recommendation that should have been given. And then we expanded that 2 years later to where, if it was NCCN very low-risk prostate cancer and life expectancy was less than 20 years, active surveillance is the only recommendation that should have been given. This has 2 things of benefit to men. It avoids the side effects of unnecessary treatment, but it will also make PSA perform better. If we quit treating people that didn't need to be treated, then it's one more step to quit diagnosing cancer that didn't need to be found. And so I'm very hopeful that we can right-size PSA so that then it'll be easier to right-size treatment.
So, Tony, one more question from you, and after that we're going to throw it open to people with questions from outside. So one more from you, Tony.
Excellent. Yeah, I'm going to back up a little bit here to the discussion of the multiparametric MRI. Of course, the discussion here was in trying to detect higher risk cancers. Obviously, I think I go back to Oliver Sartor, who said that we're really good at finding the aggressive cancers, and we're only pretty good at finding the less aggressive cancers. On the MT-MRI, I'm going to apply that standard and sit there and say, it seems to me like as though we should have good data today on where it detected high-grade prostate cancer, and we should have at least some good statistics there that show us that it's got some success. And then conversely, what are the challenges when we see that we don't see the characteristics in the imaging scans that tell us that it's high-grade, yet there's still a risk factor that it is?
So with the great advantage to me of the multi-parameter MRI is it allows you to carefully examine the anterior prostate that is not immediately accessible to the examination finger, nor is it sampled in the routine 12-core sextant biopsy that is focused on the peripheral zone, as we learned a long time ago, is the best way to detect prostate cancer. The anterior prostate by ultrasound is very heterogeneous, so it's very difficult to see a lesion. So the real advantage, like now when somebody has an elevated PSA and a negative biopsy, my routine has been, when their PSA increases again, to then do a 12-core biopsy and then do two cores each of the left and right anterior prostate, which we call the transition zone. Well, if you think about it, the transition zone is as big as the whole rest of the prostate. And instead of doing 12 cores, I've routinely done four. And I haven't really directed them at anything because I knew I couldn't see anything. Now, we were kind of assured because, in general, transition zone tumors are less likely to metastasize and often grow more slowly than peripheral zone tumors. But here we made a mistake because now that we can image the anterior prostate, we're recognizing that in these men who we haven't before detected their prostate cancer but have a rapidly rising PSA, we're finding an alarming frequency of high-grade prostate cancer in that anterior zone that before we simply didn't know about. So I think it's appropriate to use MRI in this situation, but you still need to perform the biopsy. And I hope what you said is true, that we will then be able to cure these people because the literature has indicated that these anterior tumors are less likely to metastasize. But I'm not sure that's going to prove to be true. Again, remember, three-parameter MRI is very new, so we don't have the follow-up necessary to prove that it's really of great value, although I believe it's going to be proven to be.
So Priya, can you hear me?
Yes, Mike. I can hear you.
Perhaps we could now throw the questions open to the remaining audience, if you would cater to that.
Thank you, Mike. Listeners, if you have a question for our panel, please press 1 on your keypad, and we can bring you on air to ask your question. Dr. Mohler, we have received a lot of questions via email, and I'm just going through them. I see we have touched upon a couple of topics that the questions have come in through. But let us start with the most latest one, recent one that has been sent via email. Dominic wants to know, what's promising for men resistant to ABI and Enzo? He is hearing mixed reviews on Galateron, and he asks, are anti-PD-1s the answer?
I can't answer, and nor can anyone else, about whether anti-PD-1s are the answer. I would say the short answer to that is no. The anti-PD-1s are of great interest right now. They seem to work most effectively in men with advanced castration, I call it recurrent prostate cancer, who have BRCA1 or 2 mutations. But even when they work well, the cancers still find a way to get around the PD-1 and PD-L1 inhibitors. So no, they're not going to be the answer, but if you respond well and your response is of long duration, you will believe they are the answer.
Thank you, doctor. The next question is, can you please discuss treatment for prostate cancer that has transformed into anaplastic?
So this is an area of great interest right now. The NCCN prostate cancer treatment guidelines have been completely redone for advanced prostate cancer with the 2015 edition. Many people believe, my medical oncologist friends, that they're seeing more of these neuroendocrine and small cell cancers. And their hypothesis is that better androgen deprivation therapy using the new agents is resulting in the evolution of these more aggressive, I'll just lump them together as small cell type prostate cancers. Again, this is largely anecdotal. It's unclear whether these cancers should be treated differently than garden variety castration recurrent prostate cancer. In other words, should Taxotere still be the, or docetaxel still be the primary chemotherapy in any regimen, or should different agents be tried? Again, this is something that resulted in a change in the NCCN guidelines, and clinical trials of these small cell variants are going to give us more information in this regard soon.
Our next listener wants to know, scientists and physicians are contemplating on combining use of several biomarkers for accurate diagnosis of prostate cancer. He wants to know your opinion on that and whether this would increase cost of diagnosis as well as treatment that comes later.
So I assume that your listener is talking about combining the different forms of PSA, which is called the four of, again, I'm so bad on names. It's the H4 score, I believe.
Yeah. 4K score.
4K score, thank you. And there's also the methylation-based test. So, yes, they cost more than PSA, and the question is it worth the cost? And again, if you can better right-size diagnosis and treatment, they will, in the long run, prove cost-effective. So I'm a big believer in trying to separate prostate cancer as best we can into that which is aggressive and that which is unaggressive. If you're aggressive, then you need treatment. And where I start to have a little bit of a problem with the use of the fancy assays is if I've already had my prostate out and I have a chance of recurring, what advantage is there to me to know whether that chance is higher or lower? Either way, I'm going to worry. And in that space, you got to have a really good test, because to go forward with an additional treatment, you have to be 100% correct that your potentially curative treatment has not worked. Again, I really like PSA for monitoring once the prostate has been removed or irradiated. It's very, very good in that situation. I'm more excited about the use of the more sophisticated tests to select those men who should or should not be biopsied. I don't want to miss an aggressive cancer. And there the question becomes, what's the relative value of the new molecular test versus a three-parameter MRI? In active surveillance population, I want to be able to reliably tell somebody that it's safe to do active surveillance. So I really think these tests will find their proper spaces early on in disease, and I look forward to that happening.
Our next listener wants to know, could you please elaborate on targeted biopsy and how it is better?
So this is a burning question right now, because if you have a three-parameter MRI that tells you where a high aggressive cancer might be hiding, you clearly want to stick a needle in it. And you can do that by just putting a needle in the patient under MRI guidance. The only problem is that takes several hours and is very, very cumbersome to do. So the idea is identify the lesion by MRI and then use your ultrasound to place a needle into where the lesion is. Now, there's two ways to do that. You can mentally fuse the images. You can work with your excellent MRI radiologist to figure out exactly where in the prostate that lesion is, and then you can perhaps see it by ultrasound. I've had this happen several times now where I go, how could I have missed that once somebody tells me that's where it is? That's called a mental fusion. The other possibility is that you can't see the lesion by ultrasound, but at least you can oversample that area of the prostate. Now you can go one step further and you can fuse. There are now several vendors that have developed software packages that will take the MRI images and overlay them onto the ultrasound images and allow you to target the lesion seen on MRI while you have an ultrasound probe in your patient looking at the prostate. Again, it remains to be seen whether mental fusion is enough or whether you should have an actual software fusion of the MR and ultrasound images.
Thank you, doctor. The next listener wants to know, what is the reason why PET scans have not been successfully used in prostate cancer diagnosis so far when this imaging technique has been successful in other forms of cancer?
Yeah, so a PET scan for the detection of prostate cancer has not been very useful. The only place you can get a PET CT is Mayo Clinic, where it's being evaluated to see whether you can see using PET increased metabolism in cancers of the prostate. The basic problem with this with PET in the prostate is that the prostate is prone to inflammation, and wherever you see inflammation, you'll see increased metabolism. And the way cancers are recognized is by increased metabolism. So it's going to be very hard to separate the inflammation that occurs in many men due to the stones within the prostate and other reasons from the cancers that might be within the prostate. Now, PET CT is finding a way to perhaps give additional information beyond a standard bone scan when you do an F18 PET. And also in the research setting, you can label DHT or testosterone and see where it's taken up by tissues, for instance, in the bone marrow that shouldn't ought to be there taking up, you know, avid for androgens. So I hate to say it again, but there's a lot of work in this area, and PET scanning, though, at this time does not have a clear use for early detection of prostate cancer, and its use for better staging of prostate cancer is in evolution.
So if I may at this point, Priya, I think our hour is nearly up, and I did particularly want to thank Dr. Moller for his time, but also I wanted to thank him and all his colleagues who work with him on the NCCN for the hard work they put into the constant updating of the NCCN guidelines, because this is done every year, and I'm very aware that it's a great deal of work. So thank you very much for that, Dr. Moller, and thank you to your colleagues as well.
Here.
Perhaps you would, if there was one last thing that you would like to wish for that we might see in the next couple of years, could you tell us what that might be?
I'd like to see all these tests that attempt to better stratify tumors in individual patients come to fruition so that we can realize our goal of truly right-sizing treatment, so that people who need to be treated can be, and those who don't need it, we can avoid these treatments, because all of them, no matter how well done, have side effects.
I would concur with you entirely. I think that would be a wonderful thing. Priya?
Dr. Moller, thank you very much for being with us today. Mike, Tom, and Paul, thank you for your participation, and hope all of you will join us again for Cure Talks next. Talk on prostate cancer, which is scheduled for March 19th. We will be discussing clinical trials to enroll in with Dr. Maha Hussain of University of Michigan. Please visit our new website, curetalks.com, for information on upcoming shows. The link for today's discussion will be sent via email to all the participants. We'll be putting up a transcript of the show too on our website very soon. Thank you very much.
Thank you, everyone, for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Moller.
Thank you all.